Welcome to Woven in the Body, a podcast dedicated to unlocking the stories held within our bodies and awakening a new paradigm of consciousness. I'm your host, Christiana Dykman, a therapist, spiritualist, mother, wife, and an Aries passionate about shifting humanity's perception of who we truly are and what we're capable of achieving. We provide mentorship for professionals in the fields of pre and perinatal psychology, coaching, and the somatic healing arts. To explore the full range of our offerings, including classes, retreats, and events, visit us at www.theflowerofliffoundation.com. Don't miss out on our upcoming events and bonus content. Sign up for our newsletter on our website. Now, let's dive into today's episode. I'm your host, Christiana Dykman, a therapist, spiritualist, mother, wife, and an Aries passionate about shifting humanity's perception of who we truly are and what we're capable of achieving. Now, let's dive into today's episode. Welcome back to Woven in the Body, where we journey from remembering to creating through the sacred map of our bodies. I'm Christiana.
I'm Emily McCray, practitioner with the Flower of Life Foundation and Rebel Shift Childhood. And I'm co-host today. So grateful to be here with Christiana. We're just going to explore addiction, and not as a label, but as a language, a signal that something deeper is going on inside your child.
Exactly. Have you ever been diagnosed with addiction, Emily?
In terms of actual diagnoses, no. But I did go to AA when I was about 20 years old.
I did end up seeing a number of different therapists, and I was told, you're an alcoholic, and you're never going to be anything but an alcoholic. It's interesting, like this whole philosophy of showing up around the circle and saying, hi, I'm Christiana. I'm an alcoholic. What?
I am. Right.
I am like a universe inside. I am not one thing. I am quantum. And this is what we're here to talk about. What is the story behind this word addiction? And I love how the podcast is shaping up this first season of airing, Emily, because we really rooted in the first three episodes the cosmology, the overall archetypes, the energies of the services that we offer at the Flower of Life. And now we're really branching off into these specialized topics. Let's get down into the nitty gritty, like the trenches of our muck. So addiction, I couldn't resist. I thought, let's start there. In episode four, just prior to this, we dive into how our nervous system gets imprinted through the birth journey of a soul. We explore how our behaviors come about because of that journey. So this episode, Addiction Behaviors in Children, a signal, not a diagnosis, is because we want to shift this lens entirely. We want you to know that addictions are not genetic. Stories come with the field of your family. And if you can heal the story that's within your family line, and you can raise your vibe, learn how to regulate your body, go inside and do the inner quest, then that's when we can start understanding why I collapsed on Friday nights and I gorged myself with wine and cheese. I love sugar. What is it about my kid melting down or getting obsessed with a YouTube video? So once we can understand how we've adapted, then we can start talking about how to raise our vibe.
And neuroscience backs this up.
Yeah.
When a child's nervous system is dysregulated, or any of us for that matter, whether from trauma or misattunements, these behaviors become a way to self-soothe. They're not the problem. They're a clue. This is a paradigm shift. Addiction is such a dirty word, too. And I know that a lot of people get really anxious when they're talking about their children. And I hear it frequently. My kid is addicted to their phone, is addicted to video games.
I couldn't help but to whip out ChatGPT. Love it. And really dig into this word addiction.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you know that the Latin root of addiction is adicere? I can't even pronounce it. But what it means is to surrender. Submission means to surrender or to devote or bind oneself to. Wow. Or to be given over to a master. So originally, addiction didn't mean being obsessed or out of control. It meant being enslaved or given over to, often not by choice, but by due to circumstances beyond one's control. From this root meaning, we can reframe that addiction doesn't actually come from a moral failing or a disease, but rather a soul cry for liberation.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Liberation from these systems that have got us in this dysregulated nervous system.
Oh, indeed.
And of course, Gabor Maté frames it as not why the addiction, but why the pain.
Which we've talked about before, too, in terms of not what's wrong with you, what happened to you.
So children need attunement. They need consistent connection to regulate their bodies and emotions. And this starts before they even are born. It really starts, what nervous system do they literally bond to when they drop in? What is your nervous system as a parent when you conceive? And even if you're not a parent and you're listening to this, what is your nervous system from your parents? What did you marinate in? What were their nervous systems and what was modeled to you? So did you have a lot of connection, like eye contact or acceptance for whatever emotions that you had, or boundaries to show emotions, how to release your emotions appropriately? We're worried more about signing off a disclaimer for sex education, and yet we don't even teach our children about their nervous system and how to regulate in the body. So when that doesn't happen, when you don't have attunement, whether it's due to stress, okay, oftentimes parents that are really busy don't have time to attune. Less than half the time do you really need to be attuned. You just need to have this attunement that happens when the need is present, when the child has presented a need. Can you attune in that moment? And then go on and do your thing.
So important to say, this is not about blame, not about shame. So many, if not all of us, are doing the best we can with what we have always. That's always true. It's clunky. It's messy. It's real life. And these conversations are about investing in something that's sustainable, right? Something we can lean on and touch into for the rest of our lives. It's not a quick fix. It's not a short-term thing. It's not performative and packaged up with a bow. First, we have to have the intellectual understanding of something, and then we have to have the practice or the conceptual understanding, which can take years. Sometimes it's not instantaneous. And so I think one of the shifts here too is to, we're going to continue to make mistakes or hurt people that we love periodically, right? But could we, in the future, if we can and we notice and we can practice attunement to ourselves and our loved ones and hold ourselves without shame when we do make mistakes, I think is this road towards this sustainable path really important.
Yeah, essentially, you have to wean yourself off of the addiction of the mindset that we have in this paradigm that we live in, which is a negative, critical, dog-eat-dog world.
Yeah.
That patriarchal mindset is, it is an addiction. So in order to get out of that vibe, that negative thinking, that's what we're talking about. Because when you have that positive thinking, that gratitude, that, oh, I didn't do it right this time. What do I need to learn? And then picky. Again, reframing the thoughts that go in your mind, that does take a long time. Trust me.
It does. It does. And, and first, it's noticing. I think grief comes up for us too in there. It can feel really hard. I was working with a woman recently who's so hungry for it all. She's done so much work and research and she's read all the books. But the negative voice she has present day pretty frequently is, you're so stupid. Who would have done that? Who does that? She said to herself every day. at some point. And so it was a really interesting experience for me as a practitioner, because it's like she's working overtime to really pivot and shift and support and attune and do all the things. And yet, why isn't it clicking? There's this negative voice talking at her all the time. Do better. You still suck. You're not doing a good job. Who does that? That's ridiculous. You're failing like all the time. You got to disrupt that voice.
Yep.
That's the work.
Oh, and this, if this is speaking to you, whoever's listening, be sure to check out our Inner Child Journey course on the website at theflowerofliffoundation.com. We offer this course as an online guided asynchronous. You're doing it on your own time frame so that you can pick up just the basic knowledge that you need in your body and why you react the way. Because when you have that knowledge, it's okay. Oh, that makes sense. That's why I do that. It gives you a different perspective. We're going to do a little bit of recording today for some of our repair, like mantras, positive thinking, that you have a little repair toolkit at your disposal that you can practice. So let's go ahead and drop in. I want you to reframe addiction for us.
Not as a disease or a diagnosis to be fixed, but as a story waiting to be heard.
So what do we call addiction in childhood? We're not talking about clinical diagnoses. We're talking about patterns, behaviors that kids become devoted to in a way that signals dysregulation. And these are attempts to self-soothe. They're not moral failings. So common examples we see, screen obsession, YouTube, TikTok, Snapchat, sugar cravings and reliance on processed foods, fixations, or what we call affection leaps, like mastering a show or a game, collecting dolls, obsessing over one topic, achievement addiction, needing to be the best at anything, school, sports, image. Also, we have achievement addiction, needing to be the best at school. Also, we have consumerist behavior, which is like repeatedly asking for toys or constant need for new items. Another behavior is emotional numbing, an addiction to just having a flat effect, withdrawn behavior, or just tuning out completely. So these behaviors aren't just about home life. They're also responses to school stress, long days, academic performance pressure, as well as having lots of extracurriculars after school or before school, hormonal changes during puberty, social pressure from peers, teachers, or even just figuring out who they are, this identity development. And lastly, behaviors that aren't just from home life, this post-pandemic overwhelm, which is just conscious collective of this exhaustion, lack of tools. So this isn't about blame, it's about curiosity. And when we see compulsive or disruptive behaviors, the first question should be, where is the stress coming from? So we want to shift the frame. They aren't bad behaviors, they're signals. The nervous system is reaching for relief. It's reaching for connection and regulation in the only way it knows how.
I often like to look at disruptive behaviors as the first question being, where's the stress coming from? From the child's perspective, it's a really important question. It may not be a simple answer, but it gets you on the right track. It's messy. Right. I see this again with this middle age group where people are like, okay, you need to do your homework and you need to clean your room and you need to do softball practice. And you need to do all these things because I'm preparing you for the real world. And then we've got kids that are sneaking their phone at 2 o'clock in the morning to carve out their own time and freedom to watch some reels on Instagram or message with friends, because that social desire or need for social approval is huge during that time as well. So big. And there's a lot of pressure. And then if you got pressure at home, right? And you got pressure from friends, and you got pressure from the teachers, and like, what do we do? What does a pot do when there's too much pressure?
It's it bottoms out. Blows out some steam.
Something gotta give.
Yeah. And this is exactly what we mean by thinking of addiction at the terms of frequency, a field of energy. And that is addiction. Remember, we're going back to this root of the word. It's a devotion to. It's actually a regulation. It's right. Not a disease. It's the body's brilliant way of blowing off that steam in the middle of what you just said. What? It just gets me through it. And I'm like,
girls,
we need to step out of that pressure.
And I'm going to say, too, right now, modern parenting after the pandemic, depending on how old your children are, like, you're still recovering from that experience. And people are exhausted. I am. I'm still recovering from that. It was so intense. I'm not through it yet. And I had two school-aged children during that time. This is legit. This is real. Like, this is the formula, too. Like, looking at the baffling, dysfunctional, troubling, addictive, any word you want to use, behavior, the negative behavior that you don't like and that your kid gets in trouble for at school, or that you argue about with your spouse, that ish is stress. Simple as that. I'll tell you, it's stress. It's the body and the kid, the mind, all working together to navigate the stress in the environment. It's not a dirty word. It's stress is a part of life. It's here. We all navigate it in different ways. But some of it gets stuck. Right? Or kids need more support to navigate how to deal with certain kinds of stress. We want them to rely on their caregivers as their influence. And there are, unfortunately, things that we do unintentionally that erode that connection and that trust.
I have to see the positive.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about, switching that mindset. And I know I have a client on my table. It was a massage client. I'm really trying to get them to come and do work with us. But again, let's get real. This is, people have a resistance to working on themselves when they have something going on with their kids. So this woman's child has been expelled from school and he's at the end of the rope. He's autistic. He doesn't fit in. She has all kinds of issues. This is like the sixth time she's been there and I'm massaging her. And her arm, when you touch it, it's in total extension and it's flexed and she's not even aware of it. So I'm trying to rub her arm and I'm like, you can relax. You can relax. And she can't hear me say the relax. And there's so much tension in her body. How long has this gone on for? I've talked to her about her own journey coming in, the expectations. Her father left her family when they were young. The only time her dad would come around was to deal with problems. And the problem was her younger brother. So she was always trying to care for her younger brother to make sure that he wasn't going to have bad behavior because it was stressing out their single mom. And she's trying to do all that she can to help the mom hold up the house as a single parent. So here's this kid starting at age 5, right? Divorce, big sign. And she has so much stress on her body. So she carried that stress for how long? And then she has her own child who grew in her womb with that amount of stress to the point that she's so stressed her body's in constant flexion. Right. Mm-hmm. And her back's hunched over. She's got this curvature in her spine protecting the heart. And I'm like, can you just come in and let's talk about you first? No, I got to talk to my husband. I'm not sure. Like, we really need help with him, though. We're at a breaking point. I just don't know what else to do. And it's like trying to get through to her that he's in that field of the stress that she never dealt with. And now he's trying to grow up in his own world with all that added in on top. And you wonder why our children have so many diagnoses these days, our neurodivergence. It's because their nervous system is on blowout. because our adults out there, everyone listening, all of us need to do deep work in order to recover from what this world has handed us.
Mm-hmm.
That you may not have the money to do it, but certainly you have a brain to do reflection on what are these stressors. What are these stressors? Naming them, and you're naming them in your story. What is going on? What is your story?
Yeah.
We even know where we are. But I think we're probably around the point where you're going to tell us a little bit about this technology and how it shapes, or it really draws kids in, these screens with all this.
Yeah. So children's brains respond to technology in the same way as other addictive substances or behaviors. So real quick, I need to say that we've got to normalize addiction. If we haven't done that already, it is a human behavior. And it's really important to stay from an expanded viewpoint that it is a dependence on a thing or a substance, even though there are adverse effects, we don't stop that behavior. So it's not just screens, not just drug or alcohol. It can be a variety of other behaviors. It's doing the same thing, even though that thing results in a negative or adverse effect, and we don't stop it. So there can be unconsciousness going on there too. It can have the illusion of being supportive in a moment, especially if there's impulsivity there, like I just need it to stop right now, rather than the long-term sustainable goal. And I certainly can understand that too, where there's been lots of choices I've made in my life where I'm like, I just want it right now. I just want whatever it is. I just want to go through a drive-through and get a coffee instead of making it at home because I'm in a hurry today, right? Even though that's bad for my bank account. Like, you can apply this in a variety of ways. Do the same thing, even hoping for a different result. So addiction is about stress at its core. It's about relief, finding relief from stress. It's about potentially anxiety or loneliness. It can be about control, something that's yours when you feel like the rest of your life is out of control. And it can absolutely, more importantly, be about connection or connection to something, even if that's an illusion. So it's really about internal and emotional pain that feels unbearable. And there's something or substance or thing or person that is causing some sense of relief on that dysregulation or internal pain that's going on for us. It's an unconscious attempt to solve the problem. Very simply, addiction. However, these negative effects are strongly influenced by the amount of use as well as the family and broader context. Understanding these interactions is key to understanding how to mitigate and work with these troubling, baffling, concerning, addictive behaviors.
And it's interesting too, the sad reality of addiction is that obviously we just said it can apply to everything. But when somebody gets into some kind of chemical addiction, it's just so hard to overcome the biology. It's
certainly
like
can be. Yeah. You know,
smoking, for instance, they say that it's harder to quit smoking because of the chemicals that the body is addicted to. And that's not even like we think about meth or these other things. Once you've done it, it's like, damn, you went down that rabbit hole. And how do you get out? So obviously the things that we're teaching about and creating the vibe, we're really in that preventative state, helping create generations of children that can grow in a regulated nervous system and not open that door to like being in a situation where there's serious biological repercussions. But even then, people who get out, when we go through rehab, then they need, this is why you always hear about a dry meth head or a dry alcoholic, how they're even worse sometimes than before. The people who go through AA, do their personalities improve? Did they ever get the nervous system regulation or the emotional connection that was the beginning or the root of the problem to begin with? Usually not. And so they're having to like white knuckle it through and find other relief systems in order to bear their addiction, their personality. Right. I'm an addict. I show up every day. I'm an addict. It's no, you're not an addict. You're a human being who's wired to be in connection and around.
And who's in pain.
Right. So we're picking up where we left off on this digital addiction, but really this conversation about addiction in general and a theme that runs through our society, we're going to do for this next part is to provide you examples, real life examples of what's happening inside of families and in the relational field. And what's the kind of language or what's the paradigm shift that we're advocating for families to really consider? Because the type of work that you and I do isn't cognitive therapy. It's about seeing the energy, like seeing the whole field. It's like turning on the Matrix, right? When Neo all of a sudden sees the code. And like, that's what we want you to see is like your child's behavior and your behavior is a cue. It's a communication with what's going on in the deep realms of your heart space, of your ancestral space. Like, we're really trying to shine a light into these electromagnetic waves of energy that are shaping our lives and who we are. So we want to start with a classic example, but we can adapt this example in so many ways, which is what you and I were batting around with. The example that we have to go over now is, and it's okay, can I jump into the example? Or did you, let me pause, and I think you had a few things you wanted to say before we jump into our little 8-year-old Lena.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Just to put the spotlight back on addictive behaviors and really in children and all of us are often not about the object of the addiction itself. Right. And so we're talking about this shift, this pivot. It's really about meeting a core emotional need. So the addiction, that conversation, those behaviors, it's a surface.
We can agree. Yes.
But there's so much more going on underneath. So the emotional needs that haven't been fulfilled, or there's wounding or something got tripped up in there. We want to look at the roots. We want to see if we can figure out a way to identify the roots of a compulsive behavior. And we want to look at it as an unmet need and a need for secure attachment, regulation, and of course with self-regulation, which we hear about, I feel like all the time that people are talking about self-regulation, we arrive to self-regulation we get there because we have tools and we learn those tools through co-regulation. I can't say that enough times. So co-regulation exists between caregiver and child for a really long time before that child grows up to be someone that has self-regulation tools. And we've also mentioned in our classes and other times for sure that I have the ability to self-regulate as a mid-40s person in the world, but I still seek co-regulation from important people in my life at times too. So it's not that we want to graduate from co-regulation to self-regulation only, right? It's a little different. So there's that kind of old school thinking again, right? Like, independence, be self-regulated by yourself. Like we are biologically designed to be connected to throughout our lives. So yes. From birth, our nervous system is wired to seek connection, eye contact, soothing tone, physical presence, and early relational experiences are laying that blueprint for later learning how we manage stress or the stepping stones to learning how to regulate or manage stress. We're happening in that blueprint time, which again is in utero through age 7, how we feel safe, relational safe and safety in our bodies, and how we learn or have the ability to regulate our emotion. So when kids don't have consistent and attuning caregivers, which is true for so many of us, our big emotions are dismissed or ignored or responded to with a threat or withdrawal, our systems learn it's not safe to feel. And not that we all disassociate and shut down. Some of us get pissed when we experience that and we fight outward. So what we want to do what ends up happening then when we don't have those needs met is that we reach out for substitutes. We're designed to reach out to our caregivers, biologically designed to have that connection. When there's wounding or inadequacy there, our parents know this is not a shame thing either. It feels right when you learn it, but we're not born knowing how to do this stuff. So we reach for substitutes, screens, sugar, performance, control, disassociation, maladaptive strategies. It becomes our way of coping. And in that light, addiction isn't about weakness or pathology. It's about adaptation. A child seeking what the body needs.
Yeah.
Relief, rhythm, sense of wholeness. They're doing it through the only accessible means available. So when emotional attunement is scarce, behavior becomes the language of the unmet need. I run into this with adults all the time that mistake their trauma or their maladaptive patterns as personality. Like, really frequently, I've been there too in my life.
It's part of the human condition that we're meant to shed. That we have to grow through, that the personality is what comes on first because of what we're born into. And we have to grow enough to actually become aware of what was the conditioning that was put on us so that we can then consciously choose. This is where the self-regulation comes in. When we get at that mature level, then we can shed the personality and really step into our individuality.
I agree. We're talking about authenticity. It's really about your trueness, your spirit, your soul. And it's hard to pinpoint until you go through this process. And it feels different on the other side. It's not peaches and rainbows and rose-colored glasses. There can be loneliness to it too, because it's much different than this grandiosity we've been sold. Can you give us a case study, Christiana, about that? Let's talk about some of the details here that happens in everyday life for folks.
Yeah. And these names are made up, by the way, just for the protection of people that we know. These situations that we're going to pull out here they're universal.
Yeah.
So we have a little girl. Her name's Lena. She's 8 and she's overstimulated, which we see so much in today's world. She's undersoothed. Now, that's the invisible part, right? She goes to school and she's got this, you know, label that she is all over the place. She is reactive and they can't get her attention. But when she's at home, her attention span is constantly the screen. She has an addiction to the screen. And if you try to take it away, then she has a reactive response. And usually that reactive response is completely out of proportion of the norm for reactive responses. So the invisible part was that she's undersoothed, because when a parent comes to us, oftentimes they don't even see that the child is undersoothed, not attuned to emotionally or cuddled with or even like in alignment with just the feelings that the child is having. The child is isolated and the parents can't see it. And the reason why in this particular case is that she comes from a very fast-paced household where the parents are working long hours. She's in an after-school program. She has activities after her after-school program. And she rarely has downtime. She often even falls asleep. Maybe this hand up in this case falls asleep at the TV, because bedtime can be really overwhelming in homes in that situation where you've got both parents. Maybe the parents are working different schedules and the other parent's just so exhausted by the end of the day, like going through bedtime is hard. And so it's easy for the kid to just like clunk out on its own, like while on a screen. Okay. So this is the example. And what I really wanted to highlight is there's rarely any downtime, because the downtime, when it happens, it almost looks like collapse, which isn't, this isn't a conscious, healthy way of having downtime, which we mean integrative pausing, where you get to just be. There's no doing, there's no extracurricular activity, there's no performance. You don't have to go to school and put your mask on and be good for the teacher. It's just being who you really are. So the parents are seeing that the child has all their physical needs met. And my God, they're overachievers, right? They're working hard and they've got the check off the box of the extracurricular activity. So of course their child is getting stimulated in all the ways. But is the child having emotional presence stimulation?
Yeah.
So that's check-in. That's our example. And we've noticed that when we come and we unpack this story, we see that the parents say that she has full-blown tantrums. So how would you deal with that in your practice? Or like, how do we want to bounce this around for people?
Yeah. So I think it's tough. I work with clients like this at times, and I'll honestly, it's tough, right? So when we have a scenario where there's the overachiever or the overachieving as a goal or a value in the family, maybe they've identified that or not, but it's people, everybody's working, there's extracurriculars, their schedule is slammed. And a lot of times when I check in with families about this, if I'm working with the child, they say, my kid likes it. My kid gets bored easily. My kid does really well in sports and all of these things. And there's this narrative that they're meeting the needs of their child. And sometimes I meet these kids and I'm impressed because I'm like, this kid really does excel at these sports and these extracurriculars. And they're doing well within it. But the issue, the error that I see when I work with these kids is that, just like you described, there's no pause. So there's a lack of that emotional connection with their parents, right? And sometimes with these children, I'm serving that role as mentor, as support person, is that they're processing emotions with me because they're not able to at home, right? There's not room for it. Or people don't know how to do it, and their schedules are so overbooked and tight that it's just not part of their lifestyle. They're just go. So then when I look at that and I think into the parents inside of that, thinking these folks are running as fast as they can. What's going on there? So there's a lot of some questions I have to create this baseline. And I understand that if I'm asking folks to build in a pause, to build in more connection by way of just snuggling on the couch or on the bed before bedtime, right? Or intentionally creating some space to be together. I think people first roll their eyes at it like, that's not really that important. We do all these other things. I'm providing all of these other things that are feel more important. But okay, Emily, I'll do what you say. I'll do a little snuggling. But I think that what can happen then when we try to do that and create that space and have a snuggle time before bed and ask about the day, it doesn't just necessarily go perfectly. Sometimes then you poke at it or unleash something and there's a flood. There's a lot in there that can feel overwhelming, right? So it's better if we just bottle that up and keep going. And so I want to just acknowledge that this is a lot that we're asking. Right? We're asking people to create a lifestyle shift, right? To assess, what am I running from and therefore teaching my children to run from? And where are we going? Where are we headed? Where are we running as fast as we can to get to? And a lot of times I find we don't realize we're doing these things. And then when we do realize it, we can feel guilty and shame. And when we have all this undercover stuff come up, and it can feel really overwhelming. And so I like to really take my time with folks inside of this area, because I don't want to expect people to just flip the script. And okay, it feels real scary to stop running. We're running for a reason. We're running for our lives. And that story is sacred. whatever that is, it deserves a lot of support inside of it. And so I think this is a brilliant example. Some of the things that when we work with kids and families that are going through things like this, we start to see control come out in other areas with the children as they age. We see compulsive patterns. We see, I've worked with a kid who's 12-ish, and this example could be both for Cheryl. And inside of that, one of the things is that she doesn't sleep well. Her motor is motored up all night, but there is a good night time. But then what I've learned is that she's staying up all hours of the night. And what is she doing during that time? She eats, she has snacks, she goes on her phone, she doodles. None of it's bad, but it's almost like she's carved out some peace for herself, some choice, some freedom, some peace all on her own. But the negative side to it is she's not getting enough sleep, so then she's exhausted the next day and on it goes. So if I think one of the ways we can get in here with folks too, Christiana, is to help people understand some of these neurobiological needs for connection, security, and safety, and what those things, how do we get them? How do we recreate them? How do we bring it up, and how do we work with it when there's been wounding here?
Yeah. And I want to throw out a couple of examples for when Lena is 8 and then when she gets older and she has the first thing is that there has to be a conscious effort on the parents or one person, at least one person in the field that practices some sort of pause. And what we mean by that is like meditation. Get on an app, do a guided meditation, something that brings you a sense of inner tranquility that you can tap inside of yourself and then put out the noise of the world. And even that, speaking from my own experience with my daughter, because Lane is essentially my daughter. Like what I was dealing with when I stepped into this work. And sometimes that meant that I needed to go to bed with her to come up with some repair time. And I would lie down in bed with her and just be with her. And sometimes that wouldn't be great because there would be like some fight that would ignite between us because of, again, remember, it's not going to be pretty. There's shit that we're running away from. And that child in the family field is mirroring it. So yep. They're going to bring it up. And then it's like that. Okay, can we sit with this? And even if they're...
That's it right there, Christian. I just had this conversation. And the client said, but it gets bigger. He gets worse. He gets more angry. He tries to bite me then.
Yes.
And I said, that's it right there. I want you to stay in there and be boundary by all means. Don't let it bite you. And also don't talk about anything else. I mean, these people are having 1-2 hour meltdowns. I'm like, that's not possible unless you're adding stress to the situation because you're walking away or you're talking about something else or you're trying to manipulate or you're trying to avoid. If you actually sit in the muck, it is awful, folks. It's awful. It's so hard for all of us, but it will shorten those meltdowns by a fourth, right? A 20 minutes of sitting in the muck is awful. 2 hours is impossible.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
And there was definitely this tick down because by the time she turned 11, she was sleeping through the night. And whoa, 11? Holy cow, I went through 11 years of this. Like, we're not saying that these problems that humanity are facing right now are small problems. This is backed up from generations, and it takes the brave, courageous soul to be like, okay, I'm going to do this and I'm going to fuck it up. And even if I fuck it up, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to try. I'm going to be there. And doing that practice, that's where we see these breakthroughs. Because even my son, when I learned this technique to be with them in their emotional stuff and not say, don't do this or hush or whatever it was or whatever judgment, yeah. I was just like, I see you. I see your pain. Or acknowledging I could do better or whatever. And remember how you said, don't talk about anything else.
Yeah.
It's just
really hard.
It's really hard because, and it's like a vibration. You're in there and it's like, and you're like, this is a tornado. Like this is the tornado going over the house. And now you're in the center of the storm.
Oh yeah.
Have to hang on. And then eventually there's a letdown.
You'll get there. That's right.
Not that mucky spot. You're in the ring. Like you're in the ring, but you're not fighting back. This is not a boxing ring. You're just in the circle. You're in the space. And you have to tell yourself that it's not going to last forever. You have to tell yourself that, right? You can't believe everything you think when you're in a heightened state. And we're biologically designed to be connected to. If your kid or someone you love is screaming at you, they're telling you you're terrible or that they hate you and they're trying to fight you, you are going to go into fight, flight, freeze. And what we're saying is that it's not about not going down there. It's about noticing when we go down there and then remembering, since we have these incredible brains, that we can do things to help ourselves when we're in fight, flight, freeze. To remember that you can say, this sucks. This is really hard and it's not going to last forever. I need to, what did Emily Cristiano say? Oh yeah, slow down,
be
what I'm saying, right? Stop trying to fix it. Stop being up here and buzzing around. Sit in that mucky spot. And it's a tunnel. You got to get through the tunnel. You're in the dark. You're on a train in a dark tunnel. You're looking for the light and it's not there yet. You got to hold on. And we're looking very simply, right? Because we don't have a lot of capacity in these moments of stress. We really don't. When there's a breakdown or a meltdown, are you adding stress or are you de-escalating, right? That's it. You're either doing things that actually are helping it come down or you're sprinkling on more salt on that wound. We don't mean to do that, but we unintentionally do when we stay on that surface and we're buzzing around trying to fix or trying to avoid or trying to please or trying to get compliance. This is hard work, but I promise. I don't like to make promises, but I do. But with practice, it does get easier. Can I talk about oxytocin and dopamine?
Yes.
You're done saying what you're going to say?
This will lead right into oxytocin because human touch, once that tantrum starts to dissipate, that's when the touch comes in, when the child does do the release and it's through the anger or whatever, like the whatever the violent stuff that's been thrown at them, that's when they need to hear, I love you. Even when you show me the muck, like even when you get mad, even when you do this, I love you. And the touch, that's where the cuddle or some sort of bowel regulation comes in, that they're feeling your presence now more in a nurturing way versus a neutral way. Because when you're in the muck, it's the neutrality that you need to hold on to in your body. And when you were saying like, okay, how do we get the oxytocin back? Because when you're going through that tunnel, it can be the child is having their thing and you're tapping. I'm here. I see you. What you're doing some tapping. Or you're gently, while they're not watching you, you're squeezing your body.
You're noticing your breath.
Yeah. Yes. Or you're like literally just like breathing in.
Yes.
This is like child labor, which a lot of women don't get to experience because we have painkillers and all these other things that create that mirage, that illusion. But these are the difficult things that if we actually went through child labor, and relied on our body somatically to be present, then we would wire our brains entirely different. So this is what we're trying to model to our children, that you're able to go, you're able to see really negative stuff and still ride through a storm.
Yeah.
And this is where it goes wrong, because most parents are like in that muck and they're like throwing out all the judgment or get out of my space or whatever. They get the reactive. And this is where it comes in really handy to work with a therapist for your stuff, your own stuff. So the more that you're releasing in your nervous system, the more capacity you have to hold space for your child. And if there's bad behavior that you're trying to deal with your child, then there's definitely a story there. That's not your kid's story. It's like your story.
It sure seems like it though, right?
Yeah, it does.
I had a client this week who was telling me about how one of her many children, his many children, has behavioral issues that are really aggravating, frustrating, and triggering, as we all do. But when we really dove into it, the kid is five and they whine or get needy and demanding all at the same time. And I was asking the mom what was coming up for her. She described disgust, utter disgust with her child. And she felt really repulsed by his. And there's a lot going on and everybody has an individual story. But what was really interesting about this case, that I know this client pretty well for a number of years now. And the way that she described how she was feeling was exactly how she feels about her mother, which makes sense because there was a lot of neglect and abuse in this situation. And the disgust and held feelings towards this adult client's mother made sense. She didn't get her needs met. She had a mother that was manipulative and narcissistic and all the things. But in this situation, that those feelings were being mapped onto this five-year-old who's having these needy, whiny, demanding behaviors that are annoying for everybody and also developmentally appropriate on many levels there. But the capacity wasn't there because it looked almost identical to the wounds, so to speak, for this client. It's transference different than projection. It's like just mapped, completely transferred onto this child. And this is how, right, transgenerational trauma continues.
Which is where this is where you bring in the magic with the oxytocin.
Yes. So the neurochemicals, oxytocin and dopamine, exist in our brain. And it's called the bonding hormone, oxytocin. We all know about it. There's different ways to get it. It's released through loving touch, eye contact, cuddling, breastfeeding, emotional attunement. We experience it in orgasm and things like that as well. Oxytocin creates a sense of safety and connection and belonging that's deeply felt, right? And it calms the stress response in your body and helps rewire the brain towards trust and relationship, or wire it, right? If we're able to do this within children. And when a child is consistently met with this kind of support, that oxytocin builds that baseline of safety and their nervous system learns, I'm okay, and it's okay to reach out, I am held, all of those things. It really is insurance. And when that hasn't happened, right, when people don't have this information with their babies, those needs won't go away. That's the other thing too, is that we always have those needs. There's just those maladaptive strategies that layer on top of that wound. So we could still get down in there and do repair work. Of course, it can be more challenging later in life, but still absolutely possible to do. Dopamine is the reward chemical. It surges when we do something pleasurable or satisfying. Some of us have more needs for dopamine than others. In healthy development, dopamine is released through play and creative expression, connection. But when a child doesn't have consistent attunement and support, their brains may start to crave dopamine in other ways, especially through quick and high intensity stimuli like TV or a device, screens, sugar, risky behaviors, constant achievement can all flood the brain with quick dopamine. the body temporarily feels better or even regulated, focused, or in control, but it can be shortened because there's something almost inauthentic about those cheap dopamine fixes. And then the cycle repeats. It's really important to understand this. If a child isn't getting oxytocin-rich connection, the relational fuel the body is designed to thrive on, they're going to subsequently search for dopamine instead when they adapt. This is profound, right? If you really take in this concept here, they or we find something that gives them that sense of power or escape or release, release that comes. You can, for adults, relating to orgasm and release, the release that,
yeah.
And that's a human need, not just from necessarily orgasm, but in all aspects of life. We need release. When I help people dissect this with rewards and consequences, that's what I sub. I don't want you to reward them. I don't want, well, it's a power dynamic, but I want you to identify relief, right? Your kid goes to school all day and has to sit there and do all this work or gets their thing done. What relief do they get to look forward to after school? Is that watching a TV show? Is that eating a special treat? It might be, right? Where's the relief? Where's the relief when there's a hard conversation and we have a rupture with our family member or a child and we have to lay down a boundary and we lose our temper? Sometimes that's too much pressure. Where's the relief? Is it going to come from reconnecting later? Is it going to come from taking some space? I really like that as a reframe for folks here.
Yes. It's just the natural, it's the natural rhythm.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You do, and then you don't do. You have, you do, and you have a break. And by the way, my child's break after school is I give him he has a snack. That's our routine. There's snack and there's screen time.
Yeah, I'm with it. I think it's a great routine. I tell people all the time, don't make your kids do homework or chores as soon as they get home. It's one of
Europe.
Don't do I got it. This Let kid take a break.
We got this kid in the neighborhood that we walk home with. And as soon as he gets done with school, he's got to do cello practice. And then it's like off to the next thing. And again, you got to build in the relief, the pause,
the rest, and reconnect. And then, yeah, let's do it again later. Like, I mean, you can figure this out in a rhythm that works for you. But I think relief and the... These are basic needs, just like food and shelter.
So funny. And it's this one example that we gave. It covers so much ground for other things. You can apply this to a child who is the perfectionist, the overachiever, and they do too much, right? And they're not perfect enough. And then if something goes wrong, or if they didn't get to win the trophy or have a great performance and they messed it up, they have this huge crash out because they're addicted to the idea of perfection, right? That love must be earned through perfection. This is also a child that hasn't had true emotional connection. It's the same. And it's just these play out in all these different scenarios with how they act. But again, a child that is a perfectionist is a child that also really deeply needs to learn that you can do nothing and accomplish everything in the human body.
Yep.
Oxytocin comes from that, from being.
This is how addiction patterns begin. Not a disease, not a disobedience, but the body's brilliant attempt to find balance.
Yeah.
When its needs haven't been reliably met.
Yeah. And I know you have some language, don't you? I mean, that you usually love to try to help parents. I want to use the word reprogram because you do have to pronounce. You have to practice new language because the language has to be connected. The language is a vibration, right? And so when you're when you're in that relief stage or even out of the relief stage, right? This is like a preemptive. It's the type of language that you use with the child who has the addiction behavior or whatever. It's okay. Now we have to reprogram ourselves to have positive reinforcement language that's communicating real connection.
Yeah. And I think one of the things inside of language that's an important note is that I have lots of language examples I like to give people, but the way it comes across is a reflection of what's going on for us internally. And so if we're dysregulated or not really embodied or not sure as to what we're saying, that message comes across, right? So kids will absorb the message through the energy more than just the language that you're using. I always give that example. Hey, bub, I'm so happy to see you today. Versus, hey, bub, good to see you. Like the tone and the voice, it sends a different message.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so when I work with people on empathy, a lot of times people will attempt it when the child is raging. They're so mad. And usually if you've got a raging child or person in your life, they're fighting to be seen. They're so angry because they want to be seen and they don't think you can see them. They don't believe you. And then parents are missing that attunement part, but they're trying really hard to focus on empathy. And so they're coming in saying, hey, buddy, I know you're really frustrated, but the way that comes on feels patronizing to the rageful child or the rageful person, because it's not really what they need. They need to feel like, get it. And that's going to come through the tone in your voice. Like your example just a few moments ago, where you were like, I get it. I see you. There's like passion behind that. Like I can feel the passion, right? If you were to see that in a flat way where you're trying really hard to perform inside of empathy, right? Where you're like, hey, that sounds frustrating. There's a patronizing aspect to that that I think would be unintentional. But for me as a sensitive kid that was very rageful and really wanted to be seen, that would cause me to want to be more angry, because it shows me you do not understand it at all.
That's why with raging kids, sometimes you got to meet the energy. Sometimes you need to meet the energy and have this positive opposition, right? So this is the strategy when my son would have these rageful hits, like after we would have the moment of relief and then the connection, then there would be a strategy. Hey, next time we have these big feelings, let's beat something like that we can really output our energy to. And so then it's like learning, okay, next time we have this, which we will, I can then instep like, dude, here's a pillow. Let's punch this. And you're punching the pillow with him.
Yeah. That can be.
But it's also matching the energy. Yeah.
Sure. Sometimes I'll just even put my hands up depending on how old the child is. They squeeze my hands or hit my hands. Right. Like, I'm in this with you. I'm a part of this. So again, I'm not saying, oh, that must be hard. And you're way over there away from that can be disconnecting. Even though it's an attempt to be empathetic, oh, you must be going through a hard time. It's hard. You're frustrated. Yeah, I said no, and you're mad about that. If you hear it in my voice, it's just whack. It almost sounds.
Yeah, no, I hear it. And that's another thing about children, too. With the rage, a lot of children will tell you, I love you. And then when they say that, you have, instead of the natural response is, oh, I love you, too. No, pause, feel that love, like actually receive that love that's coming from them. And instead of saying, I love you too, it's more, thank you. Your love feels good to me. Yeah. I love your love.
And I'll just say inside of that, though, with Christiana too, it takes a certain amount of vulnerability to accept it.
Yeah, I know.
And that can feel clunky for some of us, where that level of intimacy with your child, where what you just said, to pause and to really feel into it, can feel weird.
Yeah. No, that's what we talk about. You're talking about these parents. Sometimes they come in and they're numb. And then,
yeah,
that's obviously from their own childhood of not receiving enough of that emotional vulnerability in their own caretakers. And so thus they've got guards up around the heart and it's really hard to receive. That's a practice. Oof. That's a lot. Like, so we just unpacked with one example so many goodies.
I know. And there's a few more things I'd like to say. And then there's also this language piece.
Yeah. This is a perfect natural way to say there's so many things that we're throwing out here. And we really do put it together beautifully in our online course that you can take. It's really affordable and you can watch it on your own. And it has homework for you to do. It has practice. It has printouts that you can have around your house. So that you can start naming some of these patterns and what it is that you are mapping. So I just want to put that out there. Like, we have this that we're sharing about addiction, but there's a lot to unpack and we don't want to overwhelm people. And there's plenty of resources. So
absolutely. One more deep thought here. The rewards and punishments, which I mentioned a little bit ago, they disconnect us. And we assume that misbehavior is stemming from a lack of motivation to be good. That's a really widespread misunderstanding of children. And it's deeply embedded in our culture and in systems.
You have to say that one more time because this
is going to. So,
yeah. So
rewards and punishments disconnect us. It rewards and consequences, the base here is that there's an assumption that the misbehavior that we see is stemming from a lack of motivation to be. And honestly, this is coming out of Victorian era methodology.
Chill bumps.
The children are born evil.
And we cover this in the class, especially.
Taught how to be good.
Yeah.
This is a fundamental misunderstanding. It's just not true.
Yep.
And we really got to make sense of this and work with that. I'll say it one more time. The assumption that the misbehavior is stemming from a lack of motivation to be good. Let's do a talk on intrinsic motivation. I think we have that. Okay, so reward systems assume that the misbehavior, children misbehave because they don't have a strong enough incentive to do the right thing. Also, not true. Not for some children. All children. This is just not accurate. Children are actually born intrinsically motivated. Full stop. See? However, there are many reasons why kids might not be doing the things we want them to do in any given moment, right? Demands or expectations can be too high. We like to talk about this in early childhood development. And those expectations can actually outstrip some of the developing tools that kids are learning and the skills that they're learning over time. And kids, because their brains are rapidly developing in their early years, we don't realize how much we project. Our society projects, right? We have these expectations of children that many adults don't even have the tools to do. So really what Christian's talking about in terms of attuning and this practice of presence of mind is just so important so we can wrap our head around what's coming out of our mouths and talks, right? So kids don't have the tools to cope and navigate stress and adapt. They're too young and inexperienced. They could be just tired and hungry. Earlier today, I was working with clients around food and sleep because it's a really basic thing that most people struggle with. And yet we can dismiss it pretty easily too. Oh, he's just tired. A tired 4-year-old can be extremely stressful to navigate for the parent and the child. Like, that's actually can cause a huge rupture depending on if the kid is hangry and also having sleep disturbances. You want to look at that as well as these neurobiological needs. That's the thing, is I feel like there's a really strange cultural shame about children under 7. Like, people keep it under wraps. There's so many folks that struggle in silence out there but are terrified that their kid is a sociopath, but they're sore and they're tired and hungry and really want to be seen. And the parents aren't sure how to attune. And it becomes this breakdown where people are losing their minds. But the reality is, it's actually what stress looks like on a four-year-old. Like, the other day, I told a client where they say, I said I was the lead alien interpreter. That was my job. I'm like, some of their behaviors seem so alien, seem so weird. So again, we're seeing that behavior. Rewards are irrelevant and the demands that we make exceed the child's current level of ability.
No.
We end up eroding our connection and our influence. And those rewards and consequences literally damage that intrinsic motivation. When I talk about intrinsic motivation, we could do another talk on this, but I like to remind people that we did not teach our children how to walk step by step. We didn't say, hey, kid, here's a book on how to put one foot in front of the other. That's not how you teach a baby. What? You need to set up the environment. They need to have the opportunity to be playing in the living room and be able to pull themselves up onto the couch and take those first couple of steps, right? But they're motivated to do it. And when you can create an environment that facilitates and fosters that growth, we have to remember that's what learning looks like. But when your baby was 1 or 1.5 or 9 months, whenever they first took those steps, and it wasn't perfect, we stumbled. They took a step and we videoed it and cheered. And then they fell down and started crawling again. That's what learning looks like. It's not because we showed them how to do it.
Right.
That's an example.
It's a great example.
Intrinsic motivation. Mountains of research show us that when we reward kids for doing the things that they would want to do anyway, it can undermine their desire to do them without rewards. So we can really set kids up to fail when we use rewards when it's not necessary. Let's brush your teeth or it's time to go to bed. We don't need a reward to do that. They need your connection. We need your help. We need you to go with them and brush their teeth. I helped my older daughter brush her teeth because she was like 12. She'd be a hate me for saying it. It's true. She needed me to not just remind her, but to be like, okay, come on, let's get the teeth.
Hey, yeah, no. Most kids need connection at a deep level until they're at least a teenager. And then you start to see that separation a little bit. And then when they come back, they need you.
I know. It breaks your heart. I'm still grieving it. My kids are 21 and 15 and a half. And like my 21-year-old, they just had a really sweet visit and it was really tender and lovely. But like the teenage shift. It's probably not this mama. All right. One more thing I'm going to say. Children generally want to please their parents. I promise you, even those of you out there listening that feel like you have the worst kid in the world, kids want to please their parents. They do intrinsically. Of course, that can get damaged. There are abuse and trauma and all kinds of things that happen. There's misinterpretations. But again, they're biologically designed to be connected to. That is a baseline. It is just a fact. It's just real. It's just authentic. They want to please us. And of course, they do things that make us question that. I get it. Don't disagree. And also, gotta remember the roots here, right? The reality of the situation. We may be misinterpreting something. So there's another opportunity to pause. And when we can express genuine delight and appreciation for something that our kids have done, and we can communicate, that's how we communicate our values. Thank you for helping with the dishes. Thank you for taking the garbage out. Thank you for contributing in this way. It's easy to notice when our kids misbehave, of course, but it can take a conscious effort to catch them doing the things that we want, because sometimes we're overworked and we're stressed and the house is messy. We've got to take a pause and acknowledge the road as we go.
This is a good place to wrap it up. We have thoroughly covered that addiction. We have normalized addiction. And that it is a call out of the soul for some good soul loving. You know, that's what it is. That's all it is.
It sounds so simple.
I always love sharing space with you, Emily. Thanks for coming on the podcast. And I really look forward to our next conversation when we do pump up the inner child journey again. We're going to talk about this neurodivergence conversation.
Yes.
And don't forget to tune in to the next couple podcast posts. We're going to include some mantras and some tools for how you can practice moving yourself out of a dissociative state, also for tracking your emotional regulation, all kinds of goodies and tools. So take a look at the next couple podcasts.
So I'm excited, and I hope you have a good day.
Thanks, you too. Bye.